They fail to generalize for lots of things. So our speech recognizers do terrible with new dialects. They don't track speaking styles. If you put in a new word, it completely refuses to understand what the new word is. And there's been some work about that, but it's not very interesting. It doesn't manage non-speech acoustic events like you do. It has trouble managing speakers that are sort of outside of its training set. And acoustic variation, if it wasn't in the training set, can be really a problem. One of the interesting things is near-field versus far-field mics, both which have absolutely fine signal to noise and they're quite intelligible. If you train on one, then the speech recognizer fails on the other. And this is completely insane. So there are some hacks that we've tried to fix this up. We've tried modeling durations of things, and that's slightly successful. If you look at the formulation of a model, you get information from the acoustics and the information from the language model, and if you had the right model, then those two sets of information would simply merge. In our speech recognizers, if you do the merge, it won't work. You have to wait 1/7 times as much as the other in order to get anything to work. Or sometimes 17.3. This is a problem. There's been a lot of work. You have to get an insertion penalty to go after a new to decide to start a new word in the decoder, and that's sort of out of thin air. And finally, there's been a tremendous amount of work in pronunciation modeling. You build a speech recognizer, you get it, you train it on some person who speaks differently than the accent that was assumed in the lexicon, and you train it up and it works just fine, and then you try to fix the lexicon up for the pronunciation of the guy, and it's the same. We learn, the models are so stupid that they learn systematic pronunciation variations, and they learn them in the probabilities applied to the lexicon, and it just doesn't matter. So no one has been successful in making speech recognizers better by accounting for the pronunciations. It's quite an unpleasant situation. We've done a lot of psychophysical acoustics, including me, and They do moderate performance, and they work pretty well, and they're similar to our noise robust algorithms, and they're still in wide use. Hynek did PLP. Malfrequency filters have taken over the world. Deep neural nets are now the latest thing, and I'll show you why I think deep neural nets are so much rubbish. An interesting thing I think that I had part of, but it's interesting for a different reason. We have vocal tract length normalization. So everybody has a vocal tract, and it's got some length. Helmholtz talked about the variation of resonant frequencies with the length of a resonator. So this is 1862. So the fact that resonators change their frequencies with respect to length is not new. So we built a simple physical model in the first workshop that I started in 1993. At Rutgers, actually 94. What happened was you can build a model, and it turns out that the performance of a recognizer is pretty broad with respect to this one parameter, so you can set it roughly with a few simple experiments. And then we got 5% accuracy increase, actually sometimes 25% accuracy increase. And so the question you have to ask is, how come you get one parameter that'll give you a 5 or 6% increase when you have a million parameter system? So something is really funny here. There's a sort of a mismatch between the observation about the vocal tract length and all of this junk that's in your hidden markup model. So I want to go off for a minute and talk a little bit about astronomy. One of the questions in science is you have to figure out what you're going to observe and what you're going to try to model. There's always a tension between the data and the field that you're trying to build models for. And you have to bound the field properly if you're going to make progress. And sometimes people do that and sometimes they don't. And it's interesting to observe what happens. So this is sort of a... We're going to talk about the data and go on. the Egyptians are really interesting. I've just finished being a part-time editor for a book about the Egyptians and the Nubians and curbstones in Ireland. So sometime if you want to talk about that, I'll be happy to tell you the story. It's quite interesting. But the Egyptians themselves, if you look at the Egyptian readings, they did, in fact, observe that there were stars and there were planets. I think planet means wanderer in Greek. So planets, if you look at the heavens, and you look at the heavens the next night, most of the things are the same, but some things move around. And the planets are those things that move around. So they've known that a long time. The Egyptians assumed Earth was surrounded by water. Not terrible assumption given where they were. They had no attention to these sort of periodic big phenomena that other people paid attention to with eclipses. They were always a surprise. They had a very simple calendar. But they did, when they observed the heavens, they did observe cloud cover, rainfall, wind speed. After all, what was important in Egypt was whether or not there was going to be a flood so the Nile would give them crops. That was the crucial thing. So all of their writings are about figuring out whether the Nile was going to flood. And here's a place where their models of the heavens were very simple, and we think, as an astronomer, which I'm not, but the astronomers think they built the domain of discourse in the wrong place. They built the region that they're trying to model in the wrong place. It didn't tell them about what was going on in the heavens.
Out that this should be the length of the year.
Ah, yeah. Well, you know who did it? The Babylonians.
Okay,
so the Babylonians kept records of what was going on. They were inland, and they didn't care about when it was going to rain. And they looked at the heavens and saw these roving things and these eclipses, and they, over a long period of time, kept wonderful records, and they were able to predict these things. It turns out eclipses run on a 225-month cycle. So you need to know for a while when the last eclipse was, and then you find out it's actually 225 months plus a quarter day, a third of a day, plus eight hours. And so once you figure that out, you can predict the eclipses for a long time. And the Babylonians knew how to do that. They also observed this funny thing called retrograde motion, which I'll show you in a minute. And that turns out to be the crucial observation in trying to figure out what's going on with planets. They were computing how the moon moved in the heavens and tried to build some arithmetic around that. But one of the funny things about the sky is there are lots of things that people used to know that they've sort of forgotten, and now we're sort of rediscovering. So one of these things I want to show you, this is just sort of fun because it's related to this book that I've been doing. If you look at Venus, if you're trying to build a calendar, and you look at Venus, there are these very funny things that happen to Venus as it comes on your side of the sun. And the phenomenon is called the horns of Venus. And this is by day, and this shape of Venus, which you'll see is going to rotate around, is observable by eye when the sun's up, if you look in the right place. And this cycle repeats for every eight times the Earth goes around the sun, Venus goes around five times. That's a perfect ratio. So there's a calendar, an eight-year calendar, that you can tell based on where Venus is a lot about what the day is. And so there's a very, very strong periodic structure. And people sort of don't pay attention to that. So now I want to talk a little bit about retrograde motion. So there's fixed background stars. Remember I told you that most of the stars remain in the same place. The whole thing rotates around, but they're sort of the same every time you plot them. But if you look at the planets with respect to those background stars, you see this really screwy characteristic. This is Mars, and here's the date. So you're looking once a day. And this is what Mars does. It doesn't sort of go left to right. It goes and backs up and goes. And Mars and Venus and other planets do the same thing. These are observed from the Earth. And this retrograde motion was a lot of problems if you're a Greek and you're trying to fix trying to build a model of what's going on in the heavens with respect to Aristotle, who told you that there's only two kinds of motion, straight line on the Earth and circular in the heavens. Well, it's trouble to get circular here. So a lot of astronomy is about this problem. What's going on with retrograde motion of the planets? And it tells you what's happening in the solar system. So we're trying to build models of the solar system. And Pythagoras was the first guy that built a model that I know of. And he said, well, all the planets are on crystal spheres and they rotate with respect to each other. So you got a picture that looks like this. Excuse me?
What was that last third point?
What did I say? Oh, Greeks were from California. I had a friend who was a lawyer. He was the head of the group in the Navy that did cryptanalysis from World War II that helped break Enigma. And he retired and worked at IDA for a while. Then he moved to California. And I saw him in Princeton, New Jersey. And I said, how are you doing in California? He said, California is great because it's really simple. There's only four things that matter in California. Earth, air, fire, and water. So that's what that was about. Thank you for asking. So he had this crystal sphere model, and it turned out this didn't quite, I mean, from a thinking perspective, from an Aristotelian perspective, if you ignore the data, this works fine, but it doesn't match the data. So then along came Ptolemy, who was, I think, in Alexandria, and he tried to figure out how to represent what's happening with the planets and still stay within the Aristotelian system with the Earth in the center of the solar system. And he came up with epicycles. So what he said was the Earth is here, planets go around in cycles, then the planets go around their point in cycles, and then the planets go around that point in cycles. And it turns out he had about eight such cycles associated with each planet. From a modern perspective, if you think about what he did a Fourier transform of the positions. And so it sort of didn't matter if it was superperiodic, you were going to get a match. The model actually worked very well. And I'll show you why it works. So here's a picture, I hope, of what happens. Now we're sitting at the Earth, and we're looking at this planet, and I'm going to show you one epicycle. So the planet's going around the Earth, and then it's going around its position in a cyclic fashion, and we're going to look to see where it looks like it is with respect to this star field, which is over here, right? So these are the fixed stars. And we'll look to see where it goes with respect to the stars. Oh, wrong button. Sorry. So you see it does this retrograde motion trick. So if you get enough, you get one cycle, you can do retrograde motion. But if you get a lot of cycles, you actually match the data. It's very good. Ptolemy's model was terrific. But it had the Earth in the center, and that's a little problem. And in fact, to get it to work, you had to move it off the center. That's like adding a bias to the Fourier transform terms. So this...
didn't have to go around and have the same thing itself, did
it? The Earth stays fixed, and then this goes around some circle, and then this center, something goes around it, and then this center, something goes around it, and so on. What? It's a cool model. It's a Fourier transform. It doesn't sort of matter what's going on. If it's semi-periodic, it'll work. So Ptolemy took notice of the fact that the Babylonians had this long history, and so we got these predictions about conjunctions of the moon and the sun. And Aristarchus actually put the sun in the middle, but nobody paid any attention. So Aristarchus sort of had it right. And then came the Dark Ages. So when the Greeks and Romans blew up, and Alfred North Whitehead said, Europe knew less in 2012, in 212, in 1500 than they did in 212. And that was sort of true. And I must say, Ptolemy's system, let's see, where did I put this? I'm going to skip around a little bit. It's intriguing that you might think Ptolemy's system was something that just was written down, but there's this very pretty thing. There was a computer that was discovered, and it was discovered by farmers who were harvesting sponges in 1900 on a ship that was between Crete and Africa that had sunk and was filled with all kinds of artifice, pottery and gold and stuff like that. But they found this thing, and it's From Decoding the Heavens is a book that's come out recently. And this thing looked like sort of a clockwork. And they were able to date this. It's from 86 AD. So not a modern thing. In fact, clockworks didn't happen until much later. And they tried to figure it out. And they did it by doing x-rays of these clockworks. And they saw there's wheels, and there's wheels, and then there's wheels. All these things have teeth. And it spent a very long time. And there was a Scientific American article about it not long ago. And it turns out that it's this. And it's a truly terrific piece of clockwork. There's a hand crank that goes here, and it tells you the positions of all the planets as a function of time, and it tells you when there's going to be an eclipse. There's an eclipse predictor here that has this long cycle predicts. It also has a dial on the back that tells you, they couldn't figure it out for a while. It had four characters on it, and the dial rotated, and they figured out it rotates once every 4 years. And the characters were the kind of games that were in the Olympic Games for that year. It was very pretty stuff. So this model was not only mathematical, but people instantiated it in real things, and they moved them around. And this was something you'd use on board ship. So it's quite interesting stuff. Then we have Nicholas Copernicus, who comes up in 1470. He was a cleric, and he looked at all this data, and he said, that model's too complicated. Maybe there's something simpler. I think maybe you should have the sun in the middle. And he got in terrible trouble with the church. And ultimately, he had to essentially recant and go into retirement. He also did epicycles, but it was the sun was in the middle. And he got predictions which were pretty good, but he, for the first time, got the planets. And let me show you what happens in the Copernicus system. So there's the same retrograde question. And so here we are with the sun in the middle, and the Earth and Mars, and now we're doing the same projection on the stars, and this works equally well. So you don't actually need lots of cycles here. Things work pretty well just the way they are. So you can build a system like this. Okay. So the Copernican universe looks like this. Sun, Mercury, Venus, Earth, with the moon going around it, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. And that was right. And Copernicus got that right for the first time. So, just after Copernicus died, there was an astronomer named Tycho Brahe. And Tycho Brahe did most of his work here in Prague. A very interesting guy. And he didn't quite believe Copernicus, and he didn't believe in having wars with the church. So he built this system. This system is slightly different. It has the Earth in the middle, with the moon going around the Earth, and the sun going around the Earth, and the other things going around the sun. And that solved most of the arithmetic problems, but because the earth is in the middle, I don't have a problem with the Pope. However, Tycho Brahe was a data guy. He was like Bob Mercer was for speech. Bob Mercer said, there's no data like more data. Tycho Brahe was right out of that school, and he built eye observation instruments to measure the positions of the planets, and he reduced the error rate in planet predictions by a factor of 5. And his instruments were truly monumental. This is a picture of a museum. I think this is at the Technical Institute, which I'm planning to visit on Saturday. And these are the astrolabes he was using to do measurements. And you can see that that's a real person. And you had to use steps. And so they're truly gigantic. But he collected data for a very long time. He set the stage for... He hired a guy who was sort of a klutz. He was a lab assistant. He was married. He was always in trouble. And Tycho Brahe gave him a job, and he was manipulating data. And Tycho Brahe sent him the problem of actually figuring out what the orbit of Mars was. So we're now at this place where Tycho Brahe is making all these measurements. There's lots of data. Every time you advance, you need more parameters in the model, and it sort of blows up on you. And the accuracy is not bad. And Kepler had this scheme. He said, well, this is really simple. All of these planets are on orbits that are bounded by the size of regular solids. So had triangles with boxes and other stuff. And this almost fits the data. So it's sort of intriguing. But here we've got something with fewer parameters, but it's not anywhere near as accurate. But Kepler got assigned to work on Mars, and Tycho Brahe he was funded by a prince or an emperor. I don't remember do you remember what it was?
Rudolf II.
Yeah, okay. So he went to a big dinner for the emperor, and there was lots of beer, and people drank and ate, and the rule was you couldn't get up till the emperor got up. And the emperor apparently had an enormous bladder, so he lasted a very long time, and Tycho Brahe drank a lot of beer, and he actually burst his bladder, resulting a couple of days later in his death. At the time of his death, there was all this data, and Tycho Brahe's family tried to get all the data because they thought it was worth something, and Kepler snuck in the middle of the night and stole it. And he took this data and he worked on it for a long time, and he was also here in Prague. Tycho Brahe's body was dug up in 2010 because there was another rumor that he died of mercury poisoning. And they looked, and they cut some of his hair off, and measured the mercury. And in fact, he had some mercury, but nowhere near enough to kill him. So the bladder hypothesis seems to be right. So Kepler starts paying attention to these questions about where the data points in Mars are. And he finally wrote a tome about fitting the data using eggs. Eggs are these mathematical models that have a small radius on one end and a big radius on the other end. And he had all of these different kind of eggs that he tried to fit things with. And he did. He was successful. And it turned out there was a 270-page tome. Hey, I say he's a klutz because on page about 75, he made a mathematical error that made it impossible for him to find the solution. And he made a compensating error in about page 200. So he actually found the solution. And it turned out the egg that he found was an ellipse. The parameters actually described an ellipse. So you ended up with Kepler's second law, which says that the amount of area that a planet carves out between the Earth and the positions is the same as for any particular fixed amount of time. And that turns out to be the crucial thing that allows you to confirm gravity. So when Newton came along, Kepler stuff let him confirm the law of gravity. So Kepler's model was more accurate than Ptolemy's model. It generalized to the moons of Jupiter, which, by the way, you could see. Galileo was looking at the moons of Jupiter through a small telescope, and this is what it looks like. So you could see these things going around if you had enough patience. So you sort of could tell that the model was basically right. And it generalizes to the explanations of other things. For a while, people were tracking comets, and Gauss made a living for a while tracking comets. Asteroids. Not all of them were comets, but asteroids. And the game in asteroids was you took a couple of samples of position, and then you tried to compute the return rate, the orbit. So Kepler has fewer parameters than the epicycle model, and for the first time, he's got the right form. So that's sort of what happened with planetary modeling. So I think there's a sort of story here, and that is data is essential for getting the models right, but it's not enough. There's more going on here than just collecting more data. And if the model is really complicated, like the epicycle model, you should be cautious, because that means that you might have something not quite right. And the characteristics of the error are critical. By the way, I think counting errors in general is not very smart. It's the kind of error you have, the amount that it is off, and not the fact that it's an error. So it's not enough to count. Right? So I have a problem with that. But you want to build on the previous work. And I want to tell you the short... I now have a couple of short stories. So one short story is about Fourier transforms. So Fourier transforms, you know from Cooley and Tukey, probably in 1967, but actually they're from Gauss in 1805. So Gauss was doing this trick with looking at positions of asteroids, and he was paying computers. And in those days, a computer was someone you paid to do arithmetic for you, to do multiplies. And it was expensive to get those guys. And he looked at the Fourier transform and said, oh, look at that. There's this repeating thing that I don't have to compute. And so he actually wrote down the 4x3 model that was the same partition for a fast Fourier transform that Cooley and Tukey described. And he wrote it down in his journal. He said, look at this. I can compute periodic functions with this Fourier transform. And it turns out it was terrible for doing semi-periodic stuff. If it wasn't exactly on the period, it was wrong. And he couldn't get it to work, and he closed the journal, and it was rediscovered by some guys from Rice University in about 1980. 1980, Don Johnson, in fact. And in fact, currently, if you look at NASA, we launch a satellite, and then we sort of know where it's going to go, and then you got to look, and you got to figure out what the orbit is. And the methods we use to compute the orbits are Fourier transforms done by Gaussian least square methods and not fast Fourier transforms because they don't work. And here we are as speech people looking at semi-periodic functions, and we're using the Fourier transform, which is demonstrably inferior to other techniques. So that's story number one. We've been using n-grams and stuff like that for language models for a long time. And the probabilities of our n-grams are approximate, but we have lots of data these days. Google now uses 2 centuries of speech and the associated text to get their models. And all of our models have zero Hamming distance. That is, what we insist on is the conditioning variable all has, all of the elements have to be there. So that means that if you have a lot of elements, you run out of data in a hurry. And we always assume that more data gives a better model. Although Kiprian Gelba just published a paper that said in the Google model, as you add more data, it now gets worse. So it's not stable anymore. So I want to tell you a cautionary tale from biology. I have a friend named... Peter Yanilos, who's the chief scientist at NEC. He was the vice president of Franklin Computers. He used to do all the compression for the Franklin Computers, the little handheld things. And I worked with him at IDEA, and he was trying to figure out something better than the current model is using for gene identification. So if you have this collection of base pairs, there's 4 possibilities at each position, and so you get these strings of things, and now the question that was being asked at this time is this string that you're looking at from a gene or from an intron? The gene is something that tells you something about what the animal's going to do. And the intron is just junk between the genes. Turns out it's not all junk, but in those days it was just junk. And the standard way to figure that out was to build a model. You took all the genes you had and all the introns you had, and you built a Markov model for each. And now you scored it with the relative score of the two models. And if you did that with a 6-gram model, so you take six genes, six bases, and you predict the next base, this is a 2-bit decision, you get 0.5 bits per base. Everybody was doing that. That was the state of the art. It was 0.05 bits seems like not a very good model, but if you have a long string, you can figure it out. He said, we got to be able to do better than that. He spent a year, and he made the interesting observation that if you knew the previous 20 bases, not the previous 6, and the data was in your data set, then you had a pretty good predictor for what was coming on. I'll show you this and we'll come back. So if the Hamming distance of your 20 previous things was 0 for the data, then 90% of the time you get the right prediction for the next guy. And if there was one error, so it's a predictor with a Hamming distance of 1, then you get 83%. And it, as you see, it goes down. So the more errors you have, the less good the prediction is. Well, you can take that observation and you can build yourself an absolutely legitimate Markov model. Let's see. So he used the Jelinek style interpolation. I think that's the only other thing that's here. And he interpolated all the lengths, and he included the minimum Hamming distance as part of the state. So the prediction state now in the Markov model is the previous 20 things and the Hamming distance to the best thing in the data. And you can put together a Markov model with exactly the same number of free parameters that you had with the 6-gram. So it was matched in every way we know how to match it. It's exactly the same data, because it's all done on the same collection. And now, changing this geometry gives you 0.35 bits per base, not 0.05. It's an increase of 7 in the amount of information you get from the model simply by changing the geometry. I haven't changed the arithmetic. It's still a Markov model. It's just a different geometry. So I think this says you got to pay attention to the model. It's not enough to pay attention to the performance and the data. It's the model. We're using sums of Gaussians every place I look. And here's my version of what a sum of Gaussians is. How do you produce a sum of Gaussians? Here's a model. You take a flat field, dead flat, and you put 10 cows in the field. Then you wait a day. And the height of the field at each point is the sum of Gaussians. And I think the models are worth exactly that. They tell you nothing about what's going on. They're not instructive about what processes there are. And it's simply a rotten way to get at data. The sum of Gaussians actually came from some work by a guy from IDA named Alan Richter. And when he did them, he kept the means the same. And that one I understand. The tails of the distribution were wrong. But this one, I actually must say, I don't understand. Okay, and now I want to tell you about a very interesting project called OUCH that was done at Berkeley a year ago under IARPA auspices. In OUCH, we were trying to figure out whether the statistical assumptions of the Markov models that we're using mattered. And so we assume that frames, observations at 10 millisecond intervals, are statistically independent, and they're stationary. And so we thought for a long time, this is work done by Larry Gillick and Steve Wegman, so not my work, but I was part of the project. So they noticed that there was this resampling theorem by Ephraim from about 20 years ago, and they could use that not to build a model that matched the data, but rather to manipulate the data so it matched the model. So we turned the problem on its head, and here's how you do that. You can fabricate data by taking a big block of data and building a model, and then taking a second half of that same block and labeling the model. And so when I label the model, label the data. So every frame now has a label in this second part, which had nothing to do with the training. And so now what you do is you take this label training data and you put it in buckets by the label. So I take all the E's and put it in the E bucket and all the O's and put it in the O bucket. And they don't have to be phones, they can be triphones or whatever you're doing, but think phones because it's easy to think about. So anyway, there's now these buckets of label data, all the reference to time is gone. So now you take your test data and you label the test data and then you throw away the observations. But each frame of the test data now has a label. So what you do is you look at the label, you go to the bucket with that label, and you sample with replacement and use that as the observation for that frame. So now we have a whole collection of frames that have observations which are conditionally independent from their neighbors and related they're conditionally independent based on the phone, and they're exactly what the Markov model suggests that you should, that the data is. And so now you go and decode that data. So if you resynthesize that data, you can in fact understand the speech. That's sort of interesting. Doesn't sound like anybody you ever knew, but it is intelligible. So now what happens when you go back and decode this data for whom you've imposed the right statistics? Well, what happens is, in the real speech recognizer for three different corpora, Wall Street Journal, Switchboard, and meetings, you get these kinds of data rates. And on this synthetic data, you get these kinds of error rates. It's a huge smash. And you might build the buckets on frames, that's this one. You might build the buckets on the states of the Markov model, that's this one. You might build it by replacing entire phones and do the same replacement, that's this one. And so the farther up the chain you go, the less the effect is. But it's always better than the real stuff. Now, that's not proof that you can build a model that's better, but it certainly is suggestive. And again, I think we need to pay attention to the model. As part of this project, we asked people in the field what was wrong with the speech recognizer. And they said, not robust, and it's inaccurate, it doesn't respond well to noise, and we couldn't figure it out by modeling, and it's not robust to acoustics. But basically, everybody who's in the field who's trying to use speech recognizers know that they don't work. And you can pretend they work for some situations, but we are in serious trouble and haven't advanced things very much, except for deep neural nets, which smooth the probability distributions, but don't fix any of the problems where things are really broken. So, there's some open questions. What's the right geometry? How do we include semantics? Is there a scientific model of phonetics? And so on. You can read my list. This is just my list. So somehow, it seems to me essential that adaptation is important in the model. We don't build it in. How do we analyze our errors? The answer is we count, and I think that's just a mistake. So the things, places we fail are we don't adapt to new dialects, we don't recognize speech and noise, and we don't really predict what things happen in mishearing. So the things that are open are bounding the field of inquiry. Maybe speech recognition isn't a thing, maybe it should be bigger. What's the geometry of the model? How do you separate the data from the observations? And what should be the acoustics of the solution? So, that's sort of what I wanted to say. I think I would love to see people think more about the model and less about the 1% increments in performance. I think that goes for the language guys as well as for the speech guys. So, thank you all for listening. This is foisted on you by Jan, who I was going to talk about voice morphing, and he said, you know, there was the talk you gave I liked. So, any questions?
question first, because I have a philosophy of science question. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Dan should go first.
Can you show us the bar chart with
the which?
The bar chart.
Oh, yeah, sure. Maybe. I shouldn't have closed this, but. This one. This one?
Look behind you.
Oh, how nice. I think that has to discover me. Need to do what? You think I know what I'm doing here. Huh? Before I just... Here, let me do this. I think it works this way. I believe this works. Hello? Go ahead. Yes, 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 I can. So in the first condition, the lowest one, what we did was we replaced the information frame by frame. In the second one that says phone, what we did was we took the entire phone from element to element and used those as units in the bucket.
Okay, so the HMM decodes
it
with the number of frames?
Yes, the HMM decoder is identical. Okay. It's just that the replacement elements are now phones instead of...
So they're progressively coarser replacements
in time. But as soon as you go above frame, now the length of the utterances varies as well. Because you can pull a phone that's 2 frames, or you can pull a phone that's 5 frames, and you have to account for that. But it says you keep all of the observations of the frame, of the phone together. So there's independent assumptions at the level of frames, and at the level of phones, and at the level of words. And so we're increasingly... releasing those.
So what's the difference between SIM and frame?
Oh, SIM. Remember, I said you put things in buckets. But what the thing you could put in the bucket is the model that you built. You have a Gaussian model, so you could use the bucket to create an observation stream that came from the model without having it be related to the real data. And so SIM is, we put the model in the bucket as a generator. So it actually is the model. In these, we mix up the real data at various granularities.
And word means
you
forget what phone the word is built out of.
You use a whole phone as a unit.
Whole word
is a unit. And when you do replacement, you go get a whole word. No, you have to end up with the word in order. The bucket is full of words in order. There's a the from sentence 3, and a the from sentence 7, and a the from sentence 12, and you pick one at random and replace the observations for the one that you just are building data from. So, yeah. This report about Ouch is on the ICSI website under projects. If you want to read it, it's actually quite good reading. So I recommend it to you.
So you talked about the heliocentric model as the correct model of astronomy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stuff. Like the first heliocentric models were less good than
heliocentric. That's right, at the beginning.
So, So, by what, like, are there a specific set of criteria by which you compare two models?
Yeah, well, so that's the right question, and I think the answer is yes. And so, the criterion that I would like to propose for this case is the geocentric models. When you see a new object in the sky that you haven't seen before, you need to go through all of the machinations of figuring out all of the epicycles associated with it. In the heliocentric model, you know the orbits on an ellipse. So much of the unknown characteristic that you have to put on the model, on the new element, is already determined. So it's a very much, it's a simpler model in the sense that it's much easier to compute and you know what to expect. So I think that's, the simplicity is one of those things that I think is characteristic of a better model. Now, there may be more, but that's the one that comes to mind here. Certainly, there was a paper by Hervé Boulard and Hina Karmansky and Nelson Morgan about increasing the error rate in speech recognition. And it was exactly about that point. So when I go to a new kind of model, when I actually change the model, the expectation is it's not going to be as good as the previous one. That, and so you expect to see that kind of phenomena, because typically in speech we spent ages making this one as good as we can make it, and so it's not unreasonable to expect that a new model of a different technology is initially going to be worse. We expect it finally to be better and more general. So I think generalizability, and I think that, so that's my, yeah, that's a good question. Absolutely true. No. Well, it's science. Science is not trivial, right? If you're going to do it.
Based on that, I have a question. And I have one. First, I want you to say something, but I then actually want all of us in the room to say something. This has to do with looking at errors. So we all work on some empirical thing or the other, if it's either machine translation or speech recognition or
right.
Some kind of coreference resolution or whatever else.
Yes.
And I just want to say, what are we counting and what would we rather be looking at? You should decide how you want to run it, but I'd rather hear from people as well.
Okay, well, I'll tell you that my opinion has already come out, and I'll tell you what that was, then you guys all can talk. So when we were talking about machine translation in one of the talks, it became clear to me that a crucial issue was for alternate translations. Typically, machine translation things give you lots of options of what the output could be. One of the things we don't have a handle on is which of those options give you the same meaning, and which give you approximate meaning, and how that approximation comes about. I mean, what it really means. And I think we need to do something about scaling the kinds of errors that we make in terms of how well they match the target. And the approximate meaning thing is one of those kinds of things. In speech recognition, I'm not sure I quite know how to do it. But I think there needs to be a metric on the error to tell you when you have an error that's important and when you have an error that's junk, that doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think that Ralph said that not all the errors are created equal.
Right.
And that actually is very important. And if you error it, then you don't see many things. Yeah. Especially the errors which are somehow outliers,
right,
or somehow strange, because that can tell you what is wrong with the model, and which is totally forgotten about it. I mean, at least officially, because officially we always show speech recognition.
We do what Fred said: count the words.
Or where the error is. We're talking forever with this nonsense, but we're keep doing it. But I think not all the errors are created equal. I think that should be written in every speech recognition.
It, of course, depends on your focus, right? If I'm trying to write down a transcript of something I'm going to print, that's one thing. If I'm trying to figure out what the meaning of this thing is, certainly the errors come in lots of different flavors. Some of them matter, and some of them just don't matter at all. So we need to worry about that. Anybody else?
Attempts recently, particularly by Vandenberg, to diffusion matrices rather than counting errors. So it's still sort of a counting error phenomenon. But
it's great.
A different gold standard that people...
That may be the right kind of thing.
So what he's done is fricative categorization, but I mean, you could... Yeah, these are phonemes, but I mean, you could do it in a number of different ways.
And the idea is to match perception.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I understand the idea of disbelief in the error metric, but it's still you want to grade your model, and you want to do a comparison across models. So if all we cared about at the end of the day was our phone responding to our request of opening a calendar,
yes.
So if that was the only thing that we cared about, we should directly measure its performance on that particular task and compare the model on that. We cannot just say that the error metric is wrong and, okay, the performance according to this error metric does not matter to me.
Yeah.
So it's not, it doesn't even make any sense trying to optimize for this particular thing.
Well,
so it's very, if you are interested in a specific task, why not just measure the performance on that task and optimize for that?
Well, in your case, I might want to optimize for the second best, right? So things are going
to
scale.
That's right. First, figure out what's the exact thing that we are trying to solve, and just solve for that. Rather than saying, I don't want to solve this, but let me just try to optimize for this, and then think about, oh, it's not working for what I want.
Yeah, I think this deserves some discussion, but not right this second. Sure.
Actually, this is a question of whether or not you're doing engineering or science. And so if you're doing engineering, then yes, you can just optimize for whatever it is the task you're paid to optimize for, and that's probably the right approach. But if you're actually trying to understand something in the long art of science, then that's what you're saying.
I think I would also say something. I mean, it depends if you are lazy or not. If you are lazy, you don't do what you said, because next time your boss comes and wants you to do another application, you will have to redesign the whole thing again. If you are lazy, as I am, for instance, I mean, you try to come with some solution which is going to generalize to the next problem. So, I mean, you know, opening the calendar is one thing, but it's of course it should be, it's a thing which reacts to your voice. So next time I have another application, if I do it right, I probably can reuse a big part of this solution. So it's just basically saying, searching for more fundamental solutions and simpler solutions, more beautiful solutions.
Yeah.
I think it's extremely important. And because we got into trouble with fixing the problems or addressing the particular problem which DARPA or our boss or whatever gives us, only to discover that next time we get a new database, we have to start from the very scratch again. It's terrible. I mean, this is not the right way to work. I think
we were talking about this the other day, and I think DARPA pushes you to do objective evaluation, and that's very useful. That's the thing you use on a production line if I'm going to make the production line better. If I'm going to build a new production line, it's the wrong metric. So I think what we should be doing is objective evaluation for a while, and then some subjective evaluation to give people the freedom to actually look around and figure out what they're doing. And if you flip back and forth between these two, that may be the right way to manage things. So if it's purely subjective, then you end up with crony capitalism, and I'm not a fan of that.
I think rather than flipping back and forth, I mean, I think that the issue is that the NSF budget's been slashed. Right? I mean, that it's because too much of the work is being driven by DARPA, and not enough of it's being driven by NSF.
Well,
because we can do both at the same time.
We could. It would require DARPA to give some of its program managers management authority that was other than the test result, right? And that's a stretch for them at the moment. But yeah, you could do it.
So I'm still not. I don't think I was clear when I said you should optimize the model. So in that case, when you are saying that the DARPA program is too tailored for one specific task, and optimizing for that is not leading to general growth in speech science,
right?
Like that, then you would want to redesign the way the task is designed, rather than saying that, okay, this is the task that I'm being paid for. I would try to optimize that, but that's not what I'm actually going to do. I'm going to do something else. I mean, it's like trying to satisfy two things at the same time. So I don't see what's the point in doing that. Because you are trying to build a model which is not going to do the actual task.
Yeah, I want to build a model that generalizes across accents.
Yes,
I mean,
that.
That's
it
fine.
So then generalization should be the metric that you want to optimize.
I don't disagree. I think that would be a very smart thing to do.
I just want to make things explicit.
But I think part of what's being pointed out is that the problem of figuring out what the task you want to do in science is non-trivial and probably insoluble. And I think actually what Nick is suggesting
right.
is that's even true in engineering.
Oh yeah,
and
yes.
So you can't assume that there is a task that you want to do that you can clearly.
Yeah, that's related to my comment about bounding the field of expertise of exploration.
So I really liked your comparison with science and like what we do, and there was some so then like you know figuring out what kind of models we need and that sort of stuff, and there's an aspect. That's sort of related that you might be touching on, which is like hypothesis tests. So like you might make a hypothesis, oh, I think the model should work this way. And then you can come up with like, or I think the world works a certain way, and then you can come up with tests that, you know, figure out, is this actually the way it works? So I was wondering like, if that sort of summarizes what, or is it like,
that's a summary. That's a summary of how we do science. How we say we're doing science. The thing that's not specified in that description is how you get a good hypothesis, right? And that's an open question. I don't think anybody knows very much about that, but it does seem to explain what we've done so far. So. Yes, except it's not a roadmap. It's simply an explanation.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I speak a little loud. It's okay. I just want to give. Actually, I realize I have a very good example of what I mean by being lazy or being busy. Because we try to be busy. Really. I remember at certain point in our lives, DARPA decided that we have to deal with different communication channels. Some 10 years ago, when
I remember,
everybody went to total panic, and most of the people we weren't in DARPA at the time, so we could laugh about it. Most of the performers, they said, "Oh, we have to collect this data from different microphones and everything." It turned out that actually 95% of the problem went away when we started with mean normalization or RASTA or stuff like this. Basically, such a predictable thing.
Right.
Very simple thing you do, and suddenly the problem is almost away. You didn't have to collect all this data, but people think immediately, if I collect the data, I'm working because I'm collecting the data, I'm labeling the data, it takes 2 hours, 2 years to collect the data, I don't have to think for these 2 hours, 2 years, and so on. You know, I'm busy. Except sometimes it's good to be lazy. That's what I'm kind of saying. A lazy is that you find a solution which helps you in the future. You don't have to do it anymore, but of course.
That's the same as the discussion we were having. We said, see, the right thing to do is to generalize.
Yeah. But speaking from the perspective of somebody who wasn't broke, you know,
oh, I forgot about that.
You know, it comes from the normalization, for example, and RASTA, which did some of the same things at Moore, were very low hanging fruit that we were late in discovering. But the fact remains that we've been using CMN as part of the baseline since the early 90s. And there still are all of those other ways that were very nicely enumerated, the ways the machines still fail.
Yeah.
True, but one thing was gone, basically. That was early 90s, what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well,
one thing was gone. Over the table, basically, we ran whatever John Pierce called definite, clear experiment so that science of speech recognition can grow step by step. I love these words. I mean, I know that people hate this letter to editor. You surely know what I'm referring to. It's a very clear experiment so the science of speech can grow step by step.
So,
and we don't know how to do it.
I mean, in 1988, I insisted that we create the first parallel database with clean integrated speech. And my only reason for doing this was so that we could do a controlled experiment.
Well, these guys argue. Let me say a final thing. it's a due to Jack Godfrey. He said, what you want to be doing is you don't want to be climbing a tree in an attempt to get to the moon. And so the question is, are we doing that? And I think that's what I've been trying to ask.
I heard that repeated.
Oh, okay.
Just kind of one remark relevant to all these discussions about science and engineering and art and so forth. So nature spent many thousands of years developing this capability in humans. Spoken language, I'll merge the two.
Yeah.
They were one, they were developed based on acoustics. And what was the application that was intended in that development? It was for one individual A to speak to individual B and somehow create a common situation so that the B would act the way A intended, or the two would, you understand what I'm saying? That's not like any application that the taxpayer or the taxpayers or consumers want. It's miles and miles and miles from it. Not, so the things that you would learn from doing straight science on speech, and it's relevant because when I speak to another person, I know that other individual has this enormous capacity to adapt, and I exploit that, and the person exploits that in return. And language is extremely flexible and powerful that way. And I know that this 10 to the 10th neurons over there is going to have no trouble parsing and pulling the meaning. But like I said, no consumer or government agency or taxpayer has an application like that.
No, it's not. I object. And so my objection is there's a huge push to building assistants that you talk to by voice, and that's exactly what we want.
I don't think so.
I do.
The domains are like tiny.
No, you define the domain. I don't think the objective is to have those narrow domains. The objective is to have something that's like a person that will communicate with me. And I see a push in that direction, and I agree with you, the taxpayer is not willing to pay for that.
Yeah. It's no good to complain about the applications that people want and the clunky models that satisfy those for now. And there's no reason to say that the engineers who are doing that should be doing basic science. I mean, they both have to flourish, and I can't be responsible for where the budgets go. But, I agree with you about the state of models, or I'd like to hear you talk about a little bit more about what you mean by the geometry of the model.
Yeah.
So I agree with that, but I don't think that it's necessarily a soluble problem. What society wants and what the truth is are...
I see that society or consumers don't know what they want. I think if you give it to them, they will be really happy. And I think I agree with Jody, actually.
Yeah.
Most of the applications can be actually boiled down to putting artificial kind of other side of the communication over there. You'd like to talk to a machine. I think that's, of course, on various levels, I agree. You know, some of these levels is just like ordering the dog to sit down. It's fine, but a good job sits down.
Yeah. The talk now gone 9 minutes over its time, so I think you all are welcome you're welcome to continue to listen, but you shouldn't feel they have to play. Apparently not.
No, but on the scientific side, the most practicable or actionable suggestion came from Jeff, who said that the question of what should you be measuring. I mean, he indirectly suggested that what you measure should be different for each hypothesis. If you have a hypothesis saying my model is going to do X,
yeah,
then measure whatever it takes to verify or discard the hypothesis. Yeah, no, in this case, you say you're doing science with hypothesis.
So I'm willing to talk to anybody with enough beer. So thank you all.